And we looked for any sort of glitches or oddities, and we found one particularly strong oddity. And that was right at the very end of this so-called Hyksos period of occupation, with a king of ancient Egypt called Sekhemhanretau, who was the true king of Egypt, but he had been forced south to the city now they call Thebes. And he was forced to pay taxes and dues to his Asiatic masters, King Apophis at the time. And he had his rituals and his secrets, but not much else. He lived in near poverty in Thebes at that time. But we believe the point came of real resistance, because Apophis, who took the name of this serpent of darkness that was feared by all Egyptians, which was a deliberate act to really upset the whole Egyptian people, because these Asiatics wore beards and they were quite frightening looking, whereas Egyptians were always clean shaven. But Apophis was growing old, and he didn't want to die an Asiatic death and rot in the ground. He thought, look, I'm the proper king of Egypt, they paid their taxes to me. Why shouldn't I have the secret of this everlasting life? And I can go and shine as a star forever and ever. And so he said to Sekhemhanretau, tell me this secret that you've got. And we believe that the young king, he was about 30, that's young to me anyway, said, no way, I'll pay your taxes and you can have everything, but you're not having this birthright, this secret. And so Apophis sent out a group to extract that secret from Sekhemhanretau in Thebes. And they knew his movements because he would go to the temple at noon every day, as described in Freemasonry, I have to say. And the reason he went there is because at noon the sun is high above your heads. You stand on the desert sand, you cast virtually no shadow at all. So the stain of darkness, the power of evil, is at its absolute minimum. The power of goodness is at its peak. Because every Egyptian went to bed at night wondering and worrying whether the morning would come, because they thought one night the battle with Apophis may be lost, and therefore night would be there forever and day would not come. That was their principal fear. So as Hiram-Abiff in Masonic legend went into the temple at noon, as was his normal procedure, so did Sekhemhanretau. And he was attacked. We believe that at least two of his priests would have also been attacked to extract the secrets. And he was struck several blows to his head and killed. And his mummy still survives. It's in the Cairo Museum. And the blows to Sekhemhanretau's head are identical to the blows described in Masonic legend. Now, that's interesting, but it's even more interesting when we note that he's the only king of Egypt known to have died a violent death. It has been speculated that he was killed in battle. The problem with that is there were no battles. Records are pretty good. There were no battles. So that's not true. More recently, a colleague that I've made as a result of working on this book, a fellow from Cambridge University who studied battlefield injuries, said there is no doubt those are not battlefield injuries, they are the marks of an assassination. So he was killed, and the secrets were lost forever because it was passed down the line. So we believe that there was a major problem for his sons, Ahmosis and Karmosis, in that they couldn't get their true secrets passed on to them. Certainly Apophis didn't get them. And Karmosis and Ahmosis immediately went to battle when their father was killed. And they did take the battle to the Egyptians, and they threw them to the Hyksos, and they threw them out of Egypt. They were chased back to Jerusalem, interestingly enough. Now, what could they do? They had to create new secrets. Now, we're told in Freemasonry, as we reenact this death of Hiram-Abiff, that the true secrets of a master mason were lost, and we have substituted secrets that we'll have to do until time will maybe return the true secrets. That is what happened, we believe, in ancient Egypt. that they had to recreate certain elements of that secret of eternal life. And the really interesting thing we found is that the words whispered into the ear that I mentioned as the new Master Mason is raised from the ground, gibberish is whispered into their ear. Mat neb mana mat ba'a. Doesn't make any sense to anybody. Because we're in this mode of looking at ancient Egypt, and I was starting to get a little bit familiar with Egyptian words, it sounded sort of ancient Egyptian to me, and sort of I checked it out, it was pure ancient Egyptian. It means, great is the master of Freemasonry, great is the spirit of Freemasonry. So the chances of it making sense in Egyptian were pretty damn slim. For it to actually mean that is beyond all comprehension or coincidence. I'm taking Ma'at to mean Freemasonry there because they have identical definitions. Otherwise, the words are absolutely correct. So, great is the master of Freemasonry, great is the spirit of Freemasonry, which was a sort of waving a finger in the air to Apophis, really, saying, you've had a go at us, you've failed, we're still there, we're still winning. So, okay, if we're right, the resurrection ritual used by Freemasonry that came to us via the Knights Templar and via the Jerusalem Church came from ancient Egypt. So how did it get from ancient Egypt into use in Jerusalem in the first century AD? Well, the obvious connection there is a chap called Moses, who we are told in the Bible was a member of the Egyptian royal family. He was a general in the Egyptian army, served very well, but committed a murder and had to run, and eventually released the Israelites, or the Habaru, as the Egyptians called them, the Hebaru, as they were later known, and took them to their promised land. Now, he would have been versed in the secret knowledge of the resurrection ceremony. He may have undergone it himself, because we think that they opened it out. They didn't want to ever again keep it limited to one person, because it was too dangerous. They had to have a broader base. And so he would have known and understood this ritual. And when he wanted to create this new kingdom, what else would he do but adopt the magic, if you like? Religion and magic were wholly connected in those days, and it is said that he was a magician, which means that he understood the secrets of the Egyptians. Again, it says in the Old Testament he understood all the secrets of the Egyptians. So Moses took his band of, it said, 600,000 people from Egypt across the Red Sea. Couldn't possibly have been anything like that number, because Egyptian records don't show it. That would have had a dramatic effect on the workforce, on food supplies, all sorts of things. That was a huge number of people. So it couldn't have been that number. But assuming that he left with those people and they formed the new nation, and assuming that the descriptions given in the Old Testament are true, they butchered their way from city to city, slaughtering everyone they could find, until eventually the people got to Jerusalem. Of course, Moses was long dead by that time. But there is evidence that the encampments and the towns that they established en route, the first thing they did was put down two pillar bases and put up two pillars. They are still there and to be found. So eventually the first king of this new nation, if you want to call it, of the Jews, we're told, was Saul. Then King David, the famous King David, and his son Solomon. Now, in this journey that Moses had undertaken with Joshua and others, they'd come across this storm god, this war god of the Sinai, that we know as Yahweh or Jehovah. It was a name that wouldn't be pronounced. Moses tried to trick the name out of this god, because he knew that a magician could have power over a god if you could get them to give them the name. A man could control them, but this god wasn't silly, so he refused to give his name. He said, mind your own business, I am who I am. And we're told that the Jews adopted this god as their favourite god, and he has developed into God, the one god that we recognise today. But really, all gods are just a merging of the one, in my view. And that is just one route back. But David wanted to, after they took Jerusalem from the Jebusites, David wanted to build a temple to this god. I'll call him Yahweh. But he never did succeed in doing that. Now, the interesting thing is that Jerusalem is cited in the connection between the two lands that of which David was king, of Israel and Judah. North and south orientated, exactly like ancient Egypt. It was a carbon copy. They had the two lands and they had to have the two pillars facing east. And that is why he wanted to build the temple with the two pillars of Boaz and Jarkin facing east, so they could conduct these rituals inside the temple of kingmaking. Now, David didn't succeed in doing it, but his son Solomon did, we are told. I say that because there is no archaeological evidence whatsoever of Solomon's temple. There is of later temples. So it may be mythical, it may be real, it doesn't really matter, because it's what the Jews believed that is important. On balance of probabilities, it probably is true, I think. So the temple was built by Herod, but it was one third of the size of his harem. So we can see where his priorities lay. It was not a huge building at all, and he was a great builder. Now, the problem is that Solomon was too much of a great builder. He taxed his people dreadfully. He brought in foreign people to build all over the place. And when he died, he ended up denying Yahweh. He got fed up with him and went back to other gods. And he left the country almost godless and bankrupt, which wasn't a flying start for the new nation of the Jews. His son was pretty useless and made the situation a whole lot worse, and eventually the two lands went to war with each other, and things didn't go well at all. But they had their king-making ritual, and they had their knowledge of ancient Egypt, and they had the story of the death of Sekhemeti Tau as a beacon in their legends that they passed on. Now, in 597, Nebuchadnezzar arrived and took Jerusalem, and of course the Babylonian captivity started when the elders and intellectuals of Jerusalem were removed and taken into captivity. And it's here that the Old Testament was written down. I believe until this point in the 6th century BC, it was an oral tradition entirely. And it got woven into Babylonian ideas, where we can see the connection in the Old Testament between the Epic of Gilgamesh and the stories of the Old Testament. And Ezekiel was very, very important. It tells us in the Old Testament how he brought the elders of Jerusalem together and he berated them for their Egyptian ways. He said, "It's no wonder Yahweh isn't supporting us. You're not worthy. You're really still stuck with all the old Egyptian gods." And he tells of these visions of going back to Jerusalem, flying through the air and peeking into the temple and seeing all of the Egyptian writings around the wall. And he tells them, "You've got to clean up your act and become more Jewish." And so we believe they recited the greatest story in their culture, that the story of Sekhemeti Tau. They recited it to the most important event that they knew of, which was the building of King Solomon's temple. And they called, they identified that person as Hiram. Now, other people before us have said the definition of Hiram Abiff is, Hiram is Hebrew for king, and Abiff is said to be Old French for the one that is lost. So the king that was lost would be a very good description of Sekhemeti Tau. It's interesting, by the way, that there weren't any more kings of Egypt after that. When he died, he was really the last king. There were only pharaohs, and a pharaoh was a much lesser being. It was the power of the family, the pharaoh. It was like the power of the White House instead of the power of the president, if you like. So there was a power loss at that point. So Ezekiel told these people that they had to get holier. They had to interface with their God much more strongly. They had to be holier. They had to get all the old ideas washed away. When they were released from that captivity, they returned to Jerusalem, and led by Zerubbabel, which is a Babylonian name, of course, and he built a new temple in Jerusalem, which there is archaeological evidence. And this was a more splendid temple than the original one. But that too eventually was destroyed, and Herod's temple was built on the same site. So there were three temples, or perhaps four, because Ezekiel had a visionary temple that he wanted to build, which became inspirational to later Jewish people and to the Knights Templar. So these intellectual people that returned to Jerusalem by the 3rd century BC had spun off a group that we know as the Qumran community, the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These people were determined to be extremely holy, to forge a real covenant with Yahweh, and never again to have the problems that they had experienced in the captivity. But things had never gone well. They'd been governed by the Persians, by the Egyptians, Babylonians. They were permanently, and later by the Romans, of course, permanently an occupied nation. And they put this down to Yahweh not supporting them because they weren't holy enough. So the only way to get determination, or the kingdom of heaven, as they called it, the rule of Yahweh, was to be better people. And this Qumran community, the Essenes, if we call them that, started to look at this twin pillar paradigm very closely. And it became very real for them, these two pillars. They identified that one pillar as Mishpah, and one pillar as Sedek. Mishpah is the power of the king, the control in the country, the making things sensible on earth, and the other is the power of the priest, the power of righteousness. So they believed once they'd got those two pillars in place, there would be an archway with the keystone, which would be Shalom. God would rule over them. Now, Shalom, of course, is Hebrew for peace, but it doesn't translate directly. It doesn't mean just peace, not being at war. It means all good things, thanks to God. It means your children not dying in childbirth or of disease at some young age. It means the crops not failing, droughts not coming. It means God looking after you generally. So Shalom was the state when the kingdom of heaven would arrive. The kingdom of heaven, because God would rule over them through his king. So they had to have these twin pillars in place for that to happen. And this turned into the idea of the two messiahs. They were called pillars. The references in the New Testament and in the Dead Sea Scrolls to the pillars of the church. They had to get these two pillars in place, these two messiahs. Now, there are other interesting connections. Once we start looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls with Freemasonry, Dr. Hugh Schonfield, the man who was a Nobel Prize nominee and a considerable scholar, identified in the Dead Sea Scrolls a cipher, a code called the Atbash cipher, which he also found to be used by the Knights Templar and by Freemasons. It's present in Masonic ritual, it's present in the Knights Templar, and it's present in the Dead Sea Scrolls and nowhere else. So very strange that those three should connect. So we know from the Dead Sea Scrolls that these people were prolific writers. They wrote things down, which didn't happen a great deal before then, or at least there isn't the documentation to show it. And we know from a document called the Assumption of Moses that they were told to bury their most precious scrolls under the Temple of Jerusalem, as close to the Holy's Holies as they could get them. So we were starting to get a pattern here, something that was looking like we had a continuity right back from ancient Egypt through to the Jerusalem church.